Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Judith Hardcastle, and I'm the Program Director for the Thomas Merton Society of Canada. And it's such a delight to be here. I didn't know where I was for a while, but I do now. I'm in Camrose, Alberta, and here to share Merton's life and thought with you today. How many were here for last night's lecture? Fabulous, fabulous. And it was fabulous, too. And today we'll have a chance to explore more issues about the climate of fear and commitment to peace. Before I introduce Don Grayston to you, I'd like to say just a couple of things about the Thomas Merton Society of Canada. How many people know who Thomas Merton was or know much about him? Well, quite a few people. Good. How many don't? A few people.
Everybody else.
Everybody else. That's right. There you go. Well, the Thomas Merton Society of Canada has existed for a few years now. It started as a reading group in Vancouver in 1997 and became the Thomas Merton Society of Canada about 6 years ago. Many of our programs are based in Vancouver, but in fact, many are not. We do pilgrimage programs all over the place. We've been to, this year, Cuba and France. We've been in the past to New York. Have we been anywhere else? I think those are the three main pilgrimage sites. We'll be going to Italy in 2008. So if you would like more information about our upcoming programs and events that happen outside of Vancouver or Vancouver too, there's a sign-up sheet where the brochures are. And I'd invite you to just put your email address on and your name, and you'll get periodic emails about what's happening in the world of the Merton Society. Just this past July, at the Vancouver School of Theology in Vancouver, the Thomas Merton Reading Room was opened. So if any of you decide to delve more deeply into Merton's life and thought, that is a rich resource of Merton's writings and memorabilia. And if you go online to the Vancouver School of Theology, you'll see more about the Thomas Merton Reading Room. It's one of a kind in Canada. So it's something that we're very proud of. This series, The Climate of Fear and Commitment to Peace, is the second in a series of conferences, the second in a half a dozen series of conferences that the Merton Society is co-partnering across Canada. The first was in March in Vancouver. We're in Edmonton, obviously, today. Next month, we're in Winnipeg, then Toronto, and next fall, Fredericton. So the Thomas Merton Society of Canada is truly national in what it does. And even if you're here, there are the benefits of belonging to the Merton Society. We have Merton's tapes, video collection that become a benefit of membership. You can borrow them. We do it by mail. So enough about the Thomas Merton Society of Canada. I hope you'll take time to take a brochure, learn more about us. And here with me today are three members of our board who are Merton scholars and have spoken all over North America, actually, and the world. I say that quite sincerely. They've been to England, Australia, speaking about Thomas Merton. Ron Dart, Ross LaBrie, and Don Grayston. And it's Don Grayston that I'm going to introduce to you now. Don Grayston is an Anglican priest. He is a retired professor of the humanities at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, Vancouver. He's director of the Pacific Jubilee Program, which is a program for spiritual direction. He's our past president, and he's the incoming president of the International Thomas Merton Society next spring. No one knows more about Merton than Don. He says wrong, but that's not true. He knows many things about Merton, and he can impart them to you in a most delightful way. So please welcome Don Grayston.
Technical difficulties. I'm supposed to wear this traveling mic, but the little red light, there it is. Good. Well, friends, it's a great pleasure to be here in this beautiful chapel. I love this chapel. And I'm very happy that the Thomas Merton Society and the Chester Ronning Center could co-partner for this. I'm on the board of the Ronning Center as well. And that's how the connection was made. And I very much appreciate the fact that we've been able to work together on this. I certainly enjoyed Jim Forrest's talk. Is Jim with us? There he is in the back row. Good morning, Jim. And really, I'm going to, in a sense, pick up on where he left off or certainly try to build on what he so beautifully offered to us last night. And my title is Thomas Merton and the Search for Peace. Now, just at the end of his presentation last night, Jim pointed to the need for at least a basic understanding of Thomas Merton's biography. So who was he, who is he, and who will he be? Merton was born in 1915 in France, in a little village in France called Prades, down in the shadow of some French mountains on the borders of Spain, as he says. And his father was a New Zealander, his mother was an American, both painters. That's why they were in the south of France. Maybe you've heard about the special quality of the light in the south of France, and the food is good too. And so there they were, and their baby was born, and it was, again, as Merton says, in the first year of a great war, 1915. So they moved very quickly back to the United States before Merton's father, Owen, could be drafted into the French army. His mother, Ruth, was a Quaker and had strong pacifist feelings and leanings. He grew up a little bit in the States. His mother died when he was 6, and when he was 16, his father died. His grandfather was very wealthy, and so at the age of 16, he was a rich orphan and somewhat rootless. He had grown up partly in France, partly in the States, partly in Britain. He had been baptized as an Anglican, but as he says rather sharply in the Seven-Story Mountain, "I don't think there was any power in the water when I was baptized." And so by the time he was 14 or 15, he was a very confident atheist. If any of you have any teenage friends or children who are atheists, you know how firm and clear they are in their atheism, or at least agnosticism. He went to Cambridge University, to Clare College, and had apparently a wild time. Although one great thing that he encountered at Cambridge was Dante, who became very important to him later, and that's where the title of his autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain, came from, was Dante. But apparently he impregnated one of the housekeeping staff, and his godfather, who was looking after his finances, was scandalized by this and washed his hands of him, sent him back to America to his grandparents. He went to Columbia University, and he discovered his capacity for work at Columbia University. I think that's a very interesting comment that he makes in The Seven-Story Mountain. He discovered his capacity for work, and indeed he had a huge capacity for work. He published 60 publications, books and booklets of various lengths before he died, and he's published 30 books since he died. He left so much material, letters, journals, monographs, that they're still coming out. He did his bachelor's and his master's degree and started on his PhD, and in the process, he was reaching a personal existential crisis, which he resolved through a series of basically intellectual movements to becoming a Roman Catholic. So he was baptized as a Roman Catholic in November 1938. And in November 1988, 50 years after Merton's baptism, I was in Vancouver at a peace center that I was working at, and we had a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Merton's baptism as a Roman Catholic. And at that gathering, we read the letter that Merton wrote to Jim, that Jim read to us last night. Do not be transfixed or fixed on the hope of results. And I thought it was quite wonderful last night to hear Jim reading, that is to say, the recipient of the letter, the person to whom the letter had been addressed from Merton, actually reading it. I mean, that gave me an incredible sense of history, you know, as it were, touching apostolic succession all the way back to Thomas Merton. So yes, Merton became a Roman Catholic, and then that set him on a path of exploration of what his faith might offer to him or require of him, and that ended up with him becoming, after a series of missteps, a monk in the Trappist order, the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. He was there for 27 years. He went in on December the 10th, 1941, just 3 days after Pearl Harbor, having gone through a process of attempting to be a conscientious objector and then having been declared unfit for military service in any case. So there he was. He was a postulant and a novice, and then he was professed as a monk and ordained as a priest, and that took him up to about 1948. And at that point, he published The Seven Story Mountain. His abbot had discovered he had incredible writing ability, and it was a bestseller in the year of publication, third in the nonfiction list in 1948. And so he had published his autobiography, and let's think about that, at the age of 33. And in the book, he says, my life is over. He's 33. Nothing else is ever going to happen to me. I'm just here in the monastery, and it'll just go on forever. So there had been a kind of psychic self-emptying in the publication of his biography. 440 pages about your life, and there it is in bookstores. There is a kind of purging or emptying kind of effect that has. And he had jumped through all the hoops at the monastery, all the hoops towards being a monk, all the hoops towards being a priest. And he was 33. What was he supposed to do now? And he had a kind of a breakdown, a dark night of the soul, 1949, 1950. Couldn't eat, couldn't write, couldn't pray. He was just kept going by the routine of the monastery, the prayer wheel, as it were, just kept him going. And something, as he says, was happening in what he called the hidden volcano. It was a struggle between terror and peace. They were both there. And then at the end of this, he says, it was the peace that was real and the terror that was an illusion. And he came back from that very strong and healthy and whole and sane. And the abbot, seeing this, made him the master of scholastics, that is, students training for the priesthood. We might say kind of an academic dean of a seminary. And he did that for 10 years, and then, oh no, for 4 years. And then he became master of novices, responsible for spiritual formation for everybody coming into the monastery. And there was a huge flood of people coming in after the Second World War. You know, people who had said, if I live through this war, I'm going to be a monk, that kind of thing. And so he did that till 1965. And the last 3 years of his life, he was a hermit of a very special kind. There was a building that had been used for conferences on the Abbey grounds, and this became his hermitage. But probably he was the only hermit in history who had two secretaries, and who, when he went to get his mail in the morning, had to take a suitcase to bring his mail back to the hermitage. One of his friends, Sister Therese Lentfer, called it a hermitage of 1,000 windows. So there he was. And in that period, after he came back from his breakdown, or his breakthrough, He became very interested in world religions, in Buddhism, in Zen, in Hinduism, in Judaism, in the mystics of Islam, and he moved forward toward a time when he wanted to go to Asia to have personal encounters with representatives of these ancient traditions. So he went in October 1968, and he was in Asia for 2 months, and went to a conference in Thailand where he had an accident and was accidentally electrocuted, not quite 54, dying 27 years to the day from the day that he went into the monastery. Why is he important? In a nutshell, I see him as the most integrative Christian spiritual writer of the 20th century. He reached out and took in almost every identifiable cultural and religious current of his time and integrated it into his own spirituality and his own understanding as a Christian of the world. And in that respect, I take him as a model. In fact, a few years ago, I realized that in absentia, I never met him. He had been my spiritual director. Really, he had guided me spiritually over the years in a very personal way. There's something about Thomas Merton's writings, many people have said this, after you've read a few of his writings, you have a sense that he's your friend and that you know him through his writings, and somehow he knows you too. But if you're going to read Thomas Merton, just a word of advice, probably not a good idea to start with The Seven Story Mountain. It's in many ways an immature book, a smug book. Many people have started reading it, hearing that Merton was an important writer, and they've sunk like stones in the middle. Better to start with a book like Jim Forrest's Living with Wisdom, a biography, which will give you the whole picture, or Lawrence Cunningham's anthology, Thomas Merton, Spiritual Master. And then once you have the framework and you see how Merton moved from narrowness to incredible spiritual breadth and depth, then you'd be ready to go deeper into Merton yourself. So that's a little bit about Thomas Merton, who he was. And I said who he will be. Yes, when he died, my sense is that he was operating in around the year 2050. He's ahead. In other words, he's still ahead of us. We've got another 44 years to go before we will have caught up with where he was in his spiritual and cultural and, as he says, transcultural perspectives on the globe and our lives as human beings and the planet. So then, Thomas Merton and the Search for Peace. The phrase that Jim used last night, the root of war is fear, as he told us, was the title of an article that Merton wrote for the Catholic Worker in October 61, and it was a rewrite of a chapter that he was working on in his New Seeds of Contemplation, which was published 3 months later, January 62. And we'll come back to that piece of writing, which Jim said quite a bit about last night, in a moment. But first, I want to share with you three statements that focus on fear. Three statements that confirm for me that our intuition in naming this conference as we did, Climate of Fear, Commitment to Peace, was correct and very timely. This is a fearful time. It is a fearful time for many people. And the first of these quotations is from the Nobel Prize-winning novelist William Faulkner. This is what he says. What threatens us today is fear. Interesting that he was writing in the, there's no date on this quotation, might have been the 50s or 60s. I'm not sure when Faulkner died. Anybody know when he died? Okay, well, 60s perhaps. So that's a point that I could make right away, and that is that the climate of fear is not new. The particular fear related to nuclear weapons, of course, has been with us since 1945. But the fear level goes up and down. And at this particular time he was writing, the fear level was quite high. It went down again, didn't it, in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then it's come up again with the war in Iraq and just recently the North Korean explosion of a nuclear weapon. So, here's Faulkner. What threatens us today is fear. Not the atom bomb, nor even the fear of it, because if the bomb fell on Oxford, and he means Mississippi, I think, tonight, all it could do would be to kill us, which is nothing, since in doing that it will have robbed itself of its only power over us. Which is fear of it, the being afraid of it. It's like Paul says, death has no dominion over Christ, having risen from the dead. Our danger is not that. Our danger is the forces in the world today which are trying to use our fear to rob us of our individuality, our soul, trying to reduce us to an unthinking mass by fear and bribery. He could have written that yesterday. The second quotation comes from Satish Kumar, writer, editor, and activist, Indian by birth, British by long residence, Gandhian in philosophy. He wrote a wonderful book called Path Without Destination. And Satish Kumar comes from, I think, a Hindu and Jain background. And he went on a walking pilgrimage. He went on a walking pilgrimage from India to Washington, D.C., with a little help over the Atlantic. But then he went on another walking pilgrimage in Britain, and he visited the Christian holy places. And I went on a walking pilgrimage myself in Britain in the spring. I walked about 400 miles, not to the classic pilgrimage destinations, but this book was recommended to me before I went, and it was a wonderful, wonderful book. So, Path Without Destination. And Kumar reflects on the meaning of the Gandhian principle, forgive my pronunciation, of Sarvatra Bhaya Varjana, or fearlessness, which is one of the 11 principles of community life formulated by Gandhi for the members of his ashrams or intentional communities. Gosh, that's a new thought just comes to me as I read that, 11 principles of community life. If we are a community, what are the principles of our community life? What are the principles of community life in Canada or within the Christian community or the Buddhist community or any kind of religious or cultural community? And so he says, fearlessness means freedom from fear always and everywhere. Our lives are ruled by fear. Fear of death, fear of old age, fear of illness, fear of unemployment, fear of failure. And I'm going to add to that fear of success. That's paradoxical. Some people are afraid of success. Fear of superiors, fear of inferiors. Fear of responsibility, fear of commitment. And numerous other fears cause us continual anxiety. To pick up on Jim's metaphor of last night, the alarm clock is ringing all day long. Fear leads to violence and war. Fear prevents us from seeking and speaking the truth. Fear forces us to steal, stops us from loving, makes us accumulate things. That relates to the question the man asked last night about greed. Well, why are we greedy? So that we can insulate ourselves from fear with our possessions. Fear is at the root of all evil. Fear is the cause of inner and outer insecurity. Because of fear, we want to control, dominate, and rule others. Fear erodes personal as well as social harmony. When I've been able to cultivate fearlessness in my everyday life and have accomplished solid trust from which all activities flow, then I am able to act socially, politically, and collectively without fear and to follow a truthful and right course of action. Well, two comments here. The first is that his statement that fear is at the root of all evil evokes the biblical statement that the love of money is the root of all evil. So this may seem to be a contradiction, but in fact, the two statements illuminate and support one another because the love of money, as distinct from the simple use of money as a medium of exchange, is an expression of the fear of poverty, which is another form of the fear of death. If I'm poor, I won't be able to buy food, I'll starve, I'll die. So it's a form of fear of death. And my second comment concerns Gandhi himself, who in his 40s realized that his chances of dying a natural death were slim, and he resolved at that time, this continues to amaze me, to live henceforth without fear. Just think of that. He's in his 40s. He thinks, my chances of dying a natural death are slim. I have a choice. I can live looking over my shoulder all the time, or I can make a decision to live without fear. Of course, it's a decision that would have to be renewed on a regular basis, not just once made. But it seems that he moved into that space of fearlessness. So, Gandhi's philosophy of fearlessness was in fact rooted in his own practice and experience. And a third and final quotation comes from 11 Canadian Muslim academics and activists and appeared in the Toronto Star in February last year under the title, Don't Be Silenced by Extremists. And this is what the Muslim academics said. A curtain of fear has descended on the intelligentsia of the West, including Canada. The fear of being misunderstood as Islamophobic has sealed their lips, dried their pens, and locked their keyboards. With hundreds dead around the world in the aftermath of the now infamous Danish cartoons, Canada's writers, politicians, and media have imposed a frightening censorship on themselves, refusing to speak their minds, thus ensuring that the only voices being heard are those of the Islamists and the racist right. Undoubtedly, Muslims were angered by the insulting cartoons, but the overblown reaction was partly due to their pent-up frustrations and partly the result of an orchestrated mischief of certain Islamist leaders. Islamic societies run by autocratic regimes are in turmoil. It is time for Canadians to stand up for the hard-won democratic values that the Islamists oppose. By rejecting the agenda of the Islamists, Canada's intelligentsia would be standing shoulder to shoulder with the Muslim community and secular individuals from those who reject both, in the region of those who reject both Islamophobia and Islamism. So yes, just illustrations of the fact that the root of war, as Merton says, is fear, as indeed fear is the root of many other ills that beset us as human beings, that in fact we permit to beset us. Now, back to Thomas Merton. What was happening for Merton and in the world at that time? Well, Jim gave us a wonderful snapshot of the world of that time last night. Merton scholar William Shannon, who's the founder and first president of the International Thomas Merton Society, in his cultural biography of Merton called Silent Lamp, he frames the period from October 61 to October 62 as the year of the Cold War letters. And that, of course, October 61 was when Merton wrote that article in the Catholic Worker. For Merton, the big issue was the violence implicit in the Cold War, violence which threatened at any moment to break into actual conflict. It was also the period in which the number of American advisors, so-called, to the Army of South Vietnam grew from a few hundred to 10,000. 10,000 advisors. And what we now think of as the war in Vietnam was fully launched. Merton came to feel at this time that it was his duty as a Christian, as a monk, as a writer, as a human being, to speak out and warn others of the perils the world was facing. Well, few of us are monks, few of us are writers, some of us are Christians, all of us are human beings. We can identify with Merton on any levels that apply to us. He believed that war as an instrument of national policy was no longer moral or appropriate, could not be considered just under the classic Christian criteria of the just war, going back to St. Augustine. Why? Because any ordinary war ran the risk of escalating into a nuclear war, which would put an end to civilization, if not humanity. Do you see his point there? We just can't risk starting a war because it might escalate into a nuclear war. So if you say to Merton, are you a pacifist? he'd say no, except in the sense in which Jim explicated that last night, someone who makes peace, a peacemaker, yes, but a nuclear pacifist, yes. So this chapter on the root of war as fear had already passed the scrutiny of the Trappist censors. In those days, any Trappist writer had to submit his writings to a censor board. But in sending it to Dorothy Day for her newspaper, Merton added three paragraphs, which he neglected intentionally or otherwise, to bother the censors with. In these additional paragraphs, he laments how the world is plunging towards destruction with the purpose of avoiding war and preserving peace. He singles out his own country, the United States, of which he had become a citizen in 1951, as the country most grievously afflicted with this madness. Just like to say a word about what that meant to Merton. It meant a lot to Merton to become a citizenship. I mentioned his rootless childhood. He had a lack of belonging. And when he went to the monastery, he entered, in his own understanding, a family. He said, there are brothers here and there is a father here, the abbot. So he belonged to the monastery. And when he became an American citizen, he belonged to his nation. I think we have a big, big work to do to help ourselves and young people in particular appreciate the gift, the privilege, the incredible privilege, if we look at it globally, of Canadian citizenship, and to live that out and act on it. One of my research assistants at Simon Fraser was a young Russian woman who, when she was 13 or 14, she and her mother, who had come from Ukraine, I think, Moldova, became Canadian citizens. And she told me, we stood there with the tears running down our faces. It was the happiest day of our lives to become a Canadian citizen. My sense is that most of us born in Canada don't have that level of appreciation. And it's something we need to struggle with. So Merton becomes an American citizen. And from that time on, he felt that he shared responsibility in a very particular way for the actions of his national community, the United States. So, as William Shannon says, in an imaginative picture, he describes people building bomb shelters where they will simply bake slowly instead of being blown out of existence in a flash. He fantasizes that people will even sit at the entrance to their shelters with machine guns to prevent their neighbor from entering. That issue was raised as a moral issue. If I have taken steps to protect my family from nuclear war, do I have a moral right to kill anybody who tries to come into my shelter? That was seriously discussed. And this, he asks, is a nation that claims to be fighting for religious truth and freedom and other values of the spirit? He goes on to insist that in such a time, the one duty of every Christian, or every aware human being for that matter, is to work for the total abolition of war. He advocates the practice of nonviolence as a practical method, and he calls on his readers to examine themselves and to identify the hidden aggressions that often express themselves in their relationships. There's a continuum, isn't there, from our relationships with the people we live with or work with to nuclear war. We may feel helpless, although I don't believe we are helpless, but we may feel helpless to make an immediate personal impact on the nuclear situation, but of course we're able to make an immediate impact on our interpersonal situation. So, the publication of this article marked his public entrance into the peace movement. To some, it was a cause for joy that this eminent spiritual teacher shared their viewpoint. To others, including the head of the Cistercian order, the Abbot General, it was an abuse of his monastic vocation, by which he had, in their view, renounced the world. They believed he should confine himself to prayer and leave politics alone. Of course, this is exactly what Hitler said to the bishops in the 1930s. They were to look after heavenly concerns, and he would look after earthly concerns. So, In April 62, Merton was ordered by the Abbot General to cease and desist from any... That's a funny phrase, isn't it? Not only to cease, but to desist from any further writing on the subject of war and peace. In fact, the letter came to his own abbot in January, but that abbot, James Fox, sympathetic to Merton and his concerns, waited until April to give it to him. A little earlier, however, and perhaps expecting that his writing was about to be censored again, he had started writing letters to particular friends, then collecting them in a book in mimeographed form. He regularly enjoyed commenting on how in the United States he had been forced to resort to the same method of underground publishing, samizdat, if you know the word, which was being used by dissenters in the Soviet Union. Several copies of the Cold War letters, as he called this collection, came into the hands of bishops during the Second Vatican Council and may well have influenced that council's strong statements on war and peace in the document called Gaudium et Spes, which means joy and hope, which concerns the way the church is to live its life in the contemporary world. And now here's an irony. As Shannon sets out in Silent Lamp, Merton himself succumbed to fear in this period. The fear of isolation in his position, the fear of being repudiated as a Catholic writer by influential Catholic leaders and writers. Merton had strong views, but he was easily shaken by opposition at certain points. And he ended up, as Shannon says, thinning out his message to make it more palatable to those who criticized him. He suffered from anxiety as he tried to balance, quote, his loyalty to accepted Catholic tradition with the demands his conscience made on him in a situation that tradition had never contemplated, namely, the horrible possibilities of nuclear war. Merton's next project on the issues of war and peace was his draft of a book called Peace in the Post-Christian Era, a collection of 17 essays, and this, too, he was forbidden to publish. However, edited by a Canadian, Patricia Burton, and with a foreword from Jim Forrest, this manifesto came off the press in 2004, a mere 42 years late. Jim Forrest notes that Merton did not foresee the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, nor, of course, did he anticipate the events of September the 11th, 2001. Yet, as Jim says when one reads the book, it is striking how often the word terrorism appears, referring not to the activities of secret groups, but rather to the acceptance by governments of tactics of war that result in large numbers of non-combatant casualties, collateral damage, as Jim was saying last night. Thus, if one substitutes Al-Qaeda for communism or Iraq for Vietnam in his text, it still makes perfect sense. There are chunks of this book that, again, feel like they were written last week. Just cross out Vietnam, put in Iraq. How did Merton do that? Because he understood the pathology of government. Now, I'm not against government. I mean, the Canadian Constitution, the British North America Act, opens up by saying the act has been written so that people of Canada may have peace, order, and good government. There is such a thing as good government, and there is such a thing as pathological government, too. If this example, again, that Jim gives, the struggle against totalitarianism is directed not only against an external enemy, communism, that's the original text, but also against our own hidden tendencies towards fascist or collectivist aberrations. And if you update it, just put in Al-Qaeda, the struggle against totalitarianism is directed not only against an external enemy, such terrorist groups as Al-Qaeda, but also against our own hidden tendencies towards fascist or collectivist aberrations. Yes, it was true then. It's still true. Always quick to spot the excesses of propaganda, he had spent some time studying Nazi propaganda, Amtssprache, the official language that was used to disguise the reality of the Holocaust. Merton would have had a field day with a phrase like, Axis of Evil. He was fully aware of the tendency of nations, his own in particular, to project onto the designated enemy its own tendencies towards violence. Projection is not something just that individuals do. Projection is something that groups and nations do. Thus, from the chapter The Root of War is Fear in New Seeds, this statement: when I pray for peace, I pray God to pacify, that is, make peaceful. Merton often used words with a Latin root, conscious of their specific Latin meaning. He was an incredible linguist. Not only the Russians and the Chinese, but above all, my own nation and myself. When I pray for peace, I pray to be protected. And here he uses a very dated word, which you may be amused to hear. We haven't heard it in common parlance for a long time. I pray to be protected not only from the Reds, remember that? But also from the folly and blindness of my own country. When I pray for peace, I pray not only that the enemies of my country may cease to want war, but above all that my own country will cease to do the things that make war inevitable. He acknowledged how the big powers did not hesitate to take action against the general consensus of the United Nations when it suited them, as we have seen so often in recent years. He challenged the naivete of those of his fellow citizens, surely, sadly, the majority, then as now, who, quote, considered themselves quite harmless, decent, and easygoing people who only asked to be left alone to make money and have a good time. He reminds his readers that, quote, Christ waves no flags, and that Christianity belongs to no political power block, unquote. But we have to acknowledge that there he speaks in ideal terms, because even if Christ himself has waved no flags, the religious community which bears his name has regularly done so through history. It has in many times and places become what Merton calls a materialistic neo-paganism with a Christian veneer. I know that I don't need to belabor the exactness of these words as a description of the excesses of the Christian right, both in this country and in the United States at this time. And where does all this violence and hypocrisy and flag waving come from? As simply stated at the beginning of his chapter in New Seeds, from fear. So he points fearful believers, fearful readers, towards the fearlessness that he sees in Jesus and in Gandhi. And he challenges atheists, agnostics, and humanists to define for themselves, if they're not believers, the philosophical or metaphysical equivalent of a faith which, in perfect love, casts out fear, which is from the first letter of John in the New Testament. If then the root of war is fear and love casts out fear, our challenge, manifestly, is to become people of love. I'm ending up in the same place pretty much that Jim ended up last night. You remember somebody asked him, what is the antidote to fear? And he spoke about love. Yes, love is the antidote to fear. Love, I'm not talking about love in a sentimental sense, obviously. I'm talking about love in a costly, communal, social, political, and personal sense. Again, a word from Gandhi, that the personal is the political. We think of love in personal terms. We need to stretch our imaginations and find out how to apply it in political terms. So then, if the root of war is fear and love casts out fear, our challenge is to become people of love, people who have picked up their stuff and moved from living in the house of fear to full-time residence in the house of love. If any of you know Henry Nouwen, that's a phrase from Henry Nouwen. I find it interesting in this regard that Satish Kumar, from a very different tradition, the Jain tradition of India, strongly influenced by Gandhi, says the same thing. I always seek love, but am unable to love because I am unable to let go of fear. Love is all I need. Love is the source of joyful living. Love is my true destiny. In love, I find the meaning of life. Love is the ground of all relationships. I am longing for love, but fear stops me from giving and receiving, from being fulfilled. So Merton and these other writers that I've quoted, they offer us a challenge and an opportunity to recognize the many dimensions of the culture of fear in which we live, to stand against the culture of fear which political fear-mongers generate, to find within ourselves a spiritual basis for doing so, to stop paying rent in the house of fear, and to put down a substantial down payment on permanent ownership of the house of love. I know we've got coffee coming, and far be it from me to stand between an audience and its coffee. But if there are a couple of comments or questions, I'd be happy to take them. Yes?
One thing I would like to hear more from you on. You spoke about a certain sense of not belonging.
Yes.
And I get the sense from reading his work that that sense never really left him throughout his life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. That's a very good comment. Yes, the question was, did Merton ever have a complete or full sense of belonging, or did he keep struggling with his need for a sense of belonging? And yes, he certainly did keep struggling. The end of the Seven Story Mountain has a little Latin quotation, which means, this is the end of the book, but not the end of the seeking. And he was a spiritual seeker, searcher, struggler, journeyer, pilgrim for his entire life. And just as I was saying that the fear level, like the water level, can go up and down in society, so Merton's sense of belonging level went up and down. When he went to the monastery, it was way up. And then after he'd been in the monastery a while, and discovered the difficulties of living with actual other people in this ideal environment. The honeymoon, it's the end of the honeymoon, and also his sense of monasticism diverged fairly sharply from the highly institutional monasticism that he was a part of, and in his book in the Monastic Journey. He talks about alternative forms of monasticism that he think would be more familial and more on the human scale. The hermitage paradox there, going to live by oneself in order to belong. He does make some comments during that period about it intensifying his sense of belonging to the human race. Right to the end, it was like a psychic scar that every so often began to throb. Quite true. Yes?
I guess just a comment on this aspect of belonging or not belonging. It seems to me it was a great gift to him, because very often belonging can become an identification so close with your religious institution, with your religious community, with your social community, with your country, with your culture, that it becomes an in and out and word thing. The sense of not belonging may or probably contribute to the ability to which you talked about. Because he looked at all the traditions, he looked at the large pilgrimage of everyone on this earth in whatever path they chose. Had he belonged, even if it was mostly in that moment,
Yes, that's an excellent comment. The comment was, belonging has a downside as well as an upside, and if you belong totally to a particular community where you cease to be critical or there's no growing edge, you can get in a rut, a spiritual rut, a personal rut, a political rut. And Merton at one point called himself and other people like him marginal. He operated on the margins rather than in the mainstream. If he had a total sense of belonging with every psychic and personal need met in the monastery, probably we would never have heard of him. We wouldn't be here today. So a very, very good point. We do need roots. As the poster says, we need both roots and wings. We need rootedness and we need the freedom to move. Yeah. Yes.
My question would be the spiritual tradition. Where would Merton fit on the Enneagram?
Where would Merton fit on the Enneagram? One of the great experts in Canada on the Enneagram is in the audience this morning, Don Kilarski. What would you say about Merton, Don? 4? Yeah. In fact, there is a book on Merton and the Enneagram called Merton and the Enneagram, which puts him as a 4. Yeah. And Don, just tell us a bit about what a 4 is.
It is the issue of belonging, of par excellence, that, you know, I don't fit, I don't connect. Where is the connection? Longing for what is beautiful, good, and true. Essentially, that's the pain. And so it experiences pain in the world. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Don. For anybody who's not familiar with the Enneagram, it's a system of psycho-spiritual temperament typology. It has 9 places on it that people can use to examine their own sense of their own temperament and their own gifts and compulsions. Yes?
I think one of the most diseased forms of this evil is patriotism, with all the certainties that go with that. And of course, we see that particularly strongly in the U.S. And if there's some kind of redeeming virtue about being Canadian, for me it is that what people constantly complain about, that Canadians don't know who they are,
mm-hmm.
they don't have a strong identity, is good.
Very, very interesting comment that. To have a fluid identity like we have in Canada is an advantage compared to the rigid hold on patriotism that we often see in the United States. There is a term for that, which is chauvinism, you know, which is, in its political sense, my country, right or wrong. And this is why I think Canada, with this relatively modest level of nationalism or patriotism, is in an excellent position in the world community. It's not a major power. It is a marginal nation, perhaps in the same sense in which Merton was a marginal man. And from our place on the margins, we can take a view of the whole picture and act creatively in a political sense. I think that's probably all the time. The questions we have time for. So thanks once again, and time for coffee.